CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Korean Peninsula, news from Seoul. The United States and South Korea launched four missiles off the coast of the Korean Peninsula on Wednesday morning, according to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff. The test was the Allies' second exercise in under 24 hours, following a provocative test launched Tuesday by neighboring North Korea, firing a ballistic missile without warning over Japan in an escalation of weapons testing programs. Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, is with me, and we welcome David Maxwell of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. David, the missile firing is something we've seen before. The response from South Korea is fresh. However, I'm concentrating on the adversary. Is there anything unusual about firing a ballistic missile over Japan? Good evening to you, David.
Good evening. Yes, it is. This missile firing, we believe that Hwasong-12 intermediate range ballistic missile appears to be the farthest that we've seen a missile fly. You know, about, I guess, almost 4,000 kilometers, about 2,800 miles. So it seems to be the longest distance, which is significant because normally their missiles, they fire for altitude and not for distance. So that's significant. And of course, we haven't seen an ICBM or a ballistic missile of this type fired since 2017, the Hwasong 15 and 16. And then, of course, before that, in 1998, the Taepodong that flew over Japan as well. So I think this is the fourth missile that's flown over Japan. And a significant event. But the most important thing is it flew for distance. It's demonstrating the capability of being able to have an intermediate range ballistic missile, which means it can target Guam and Okinawa and you know, U.S. Interests in the Pacific.
Gordon, the news reports from Japan said that trains were stopped and people were urged to evacuate or take shelter. Is that unusual?
Well, the Japanese have done that before with the North Korean missile firings over Japan. But of course, it was completely unnecessary because when these missiles do arc over Japan, and the last one is 2017, as Dave pointed out, they are so far in space that it is really no danger to the people at all.
You have a question for David.
David, I know this is just pure speculation and crystal ball gazing, but what I think would be important would be a test of an intercontinental ballistic missile, which they did in 2017. Yeah. And if we go back to that year, we then had the foreign minister at the time actually promised a detonation of the thermonuclear device in the atmosphere. Every country that has the bomb has tested a thermonuclear device in the atmosphere because you need to show that it actually works. You have any idea when they might do this, or what is your speculation on that type of demonstration?
Yeah, it will certainly be a game changer. So, you know, we've seen reports of that they might do a test at, you know, a ground test or underground test at Pyongyang, late October, early November. The South Koreans are speculating that. But it's hard to say. I think that if they're going to do that, then Kim Jong-un will believe that he can really achieve an effect that he must receive, you know, sanctions relief or something. If he believes he can back the alliance into a corner where we will make concessions, I think that's when we would see it. Or, as you said, if he feels it's necessary to demonstrate the capability, as all other countries have done, if he feels that's necessary for deterrence and for blackmail diplomacy, that he will, you know, then he might do it. But I really can't say when he's going to do that. And, you know, I think he's going to maintain some ambiguity for some period of time. But when he does it, I think it'll be a game changer.
David, there have been reports for some time about the pandemic in North Korea, and we had no good reporting that I recall. Is that still an issue there, and are they still fearful of the spread of the virus?
Well, as you recall, they made the first reports, first announcements in May that they had an outbreak. But then by August, they were reporting that they had defeated it. And then last month, there were reports that they've started masking again. And so, you know, I've called this the COVID paradox. They're deathly afraid of an outbreak because of their very poor medical facilities. And of course, if it gets into the military, it could wreak havoc with their military. So they're deathly afraid of it. And they've implemented measures to combat against it. But they've also seen it as an opportunity where they can use the justification of COVID to crack down on the population, to, you know, stem any kind of nascent resistance. And we've seen that with the border closings with China and Russia, legal trade and smuggling. We've seen the crackdowns on the markets where they have really implemented restrictions, communications, foreign currency, movement. All of this is really designed to keep the population in check. And so I think we've seen Kim Jong-un's growing fear of the population and unrest. And so he's used COVID to really further oppress the population. And I wondered if the return to masking was because he felt that he needed to continue to justify these draconian population and resources control measures that they've implemented. And it wasn't really because of an outbreak, but just to further use COVID to keep the people under its thumb.
Gordon, you have a question for David.
David, in China, the draconian zero COVID policy of Xi Jinping has wreaked havoc on society, especially the economy. What has the regime's COVID policies in North Korea done to North Korean society?
I think we can see that in the poor harvests, you know, combined with the other natural disasters, flooding and things. But I mean, the food shortages, prices, price fluctuations, and the people really don't have the safety valve that was developed after the famine in 1994 to 1996, which were the markets. You know, they've grown to some 400 markets. And by cracking down on market activity, the use of foreign currency, mobile phones, information for market pricing, all of that has really made life much harder for the people because without the flourishing markets that had been developed, they are losing their resiliency and their capabilities to survive. And now there's no hope for and no kind of relief mechanism for the population because Kim Jong-un is really taking it away. And so we really need to watch for internal instability. And we know that the people are suffering on a scale that is going to soon approach probably the arduous march of the Great Famine of 94 to 96.
David, we have less than a minute. The new leadership in South Korea, does that make a difference about the future of North Korea, that there is an adamant resistance to the provocations? 30 seconds, David.
Yes, I think that's very important. And I think that the Yoon administration is willing to make a strong response to the North, as well as the big difference is no sunshine policy. It was the sunshine policy implemented in 1997 that saved the regime from collapse. The billions of dollars that that the South Koreans poured into North Korea over 10 years to try to change the North Korean behavior, you know, it was a failure, and of course resulted in the first nuclear test in 2006. You're not going to see that with this administration, and it's going to be it has aligned with the U.S. On its views towards North Korea and North Korea as the main enemy.
David Maxwell, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defensive Democracy, Senior Fellow at the Global Peace Foundation, Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.